Welcome to the Afropolitan podcast, hosted by Eche Emole, founder of Afropolitan. On the show, we chat with Afropolitans whose footprints form the foundation of systems dedicated to building the future of a bold and progressive Black community. In each episode, our guests share their working formulas, the hard facts about leaving familiar terrain, embracing the unknown, and staying relevant afterwards. Listen as we extract the blueprints of fearlessness, innovation, and progress.
Hey Afropolitans, welcome to today's episode where we will be speaking with Obinna Ukwani, the Chief Digital Officer at Bank of Kigali. In his role, Obinna leads the development of digital products to achieve the bank's digital financial services. During our conversation, Obinna will share his experiences at Bank of Kigali and discuss the crucial role that digital technology and services play in addressing the challenges faced by Africa. We hope you enjoy this episode. Obinna, welcome to the Afropolitan podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast. How are you doing? How are you feeling?
Thanks, Eche. Doing all right. Always a pleasure. I've been traveling a bit back in Kigali now, getting ready for the start of the week. So all is well.
Definitely, definitely. Obinna, can you tell our listeners about your background and how you ended up at MIT with a BSc in economics?
So my parents, they moved to the U.S. almost 40 years ago now. My dad first for education, my mom later because they were married. And they've lived there ever since. So that's where I was born, along with my siblings. Born and raised in Washington, D.C. Was always a smart, energetic, playful, maybe somewhat naughty kid, but good kid all around. And my dad was really keen on making sure that we knew where we came from. So, you know, Igbo was spoken in the house, although I never learned how to speak it too fluently. I understand most of it. And then he finally sent us to myself, my older sister, to Nigeria when I was 11, 2 years for boarding school, to Enugu, where he's from. So, you know, had interesting formative experiences there, developed a Nigerian identity, and then I came back to do my last 3 years of high school. So, you know, he was always keen on making sure we had a good education, a holistic education, academic, cultural. So when I got back, he lobbied for us to join a new high school that was reopening in D.C. called McKinley Tech. It's a school that's been around since, I think, the 80s, but they closed down for quite a while. It was like a special STEM school, science, technology, and all that. So I, you know, in high school, I did soccer, played competitively. I also did robotics competitively, was the president of the robotics team. I also did biotechnology, so a lot of bacteriology, some genetics as a high school student. Did an internship at NIH, so just a go-getter, I guess, as a teenager. That resulted in me graduating at the top of my class, valedictorian, by a healthy margin, and it also resulted in me getting accepted to almost 24 universities. Yeah, my first choice was actually Stanford. My second choice was Columbia. Cornell was up there. I had admissions to just, you know, Johns Hopkins, Duke, a lot of schools. I think I got a full ride to Cornell. But my dad was really focused on MIT for some reason. I think it was one of his own dreams. and he felt that California was too far, if he could help it, you know, West Coast versus East Coast. So the distance and the perception that California is way more liberal, you know. Meanwhile, if you understand American politics, you know that Boston is similarly liberal, if not more liberal than Cali. I ended up at MIT. And when I got there, you know, having come from a background of doing science and tech, you know, always a tinkerer, I like taking apart remote control cars that my parents would buy for me and strapping other things onto them. You know, it's always a tinkerer, so an engineer at heart. I wanted to study, I think, biomechanical engineering. And I think my ambition was to do that and then go to med school, if I remember correctly. It's been a while now. But, you know, I ended up studying economics, which, of course, is very different. I took 2 years away from MIT after my freshman year because MIT is an interesting environment for young people. It's intense, highly competitive, and they don't really focus, I think, on the, at least at the time, I didn't feel that they had a big focus on the inner life. So, you know, I was learning a lot about the world, about myself, and it was hard to balance that with academics. So I took 2 years away, 1 year in DC, 1 year living on my own in Boston. And it was during this time that I traveled back to Nigeria. This was after maybe almost a decade, you know, after when I left before high school for those 2 years in boarding school. And I met my peers, who I had befriended. We used to literally run the streets together, have fun, do things, watch movies, just boys, you know, and we were peers at the time. But coming back just as a first year MIT student, gap between our accomplishments was cavernous. I mean, it was disheartening because I love these guys, you know, and, I just thought to myself, like, how has the country just failed them like this, you know? And it was at that point that I developed a passion for entrepreneurship and education, but also I really wanted to understand, like, why some countries succeed and why others fail and what could be done, if anything, to help our own countries succeed. Right. And I then looked at economics as it relates to development in the same way that biology relates to life, right? Like biology gives you the building blocks, tells you what life is all about. And I think economics does the same for, you know, development, economy, obviously. So I felt that was a really good way to fundamentally understand why things are the way they are. And I think by and large, I got exactly what I was looking for. You know, and studying economics, as much as it enriched me, it did not take away from, I guess, my innate affinity towards, like, technical things in engineering. I was a self-taught coder. You know, I taught robotics during my first few summers after MIT. Yeah, so generally well-rounded education. And that's how I ended up studying economics at MIT.
Thank you, Obi. So I wanted to dig deeper, right? So can you talk us through the decision to return to Nigeria and the role you wanted to play in nation building and creating opportunities in your home country? And specifically, right, what are some of the initiatives that you launched after returning to Nigeria?
I moved to Nigeria in 2015. This is after trying my hand at entrepreneurship in the U.S., started a tech company or small tech startup with some friends, did that for 8 months. And then I turned my attention towards education. Now, while I was at MIT, for 3 summers, I pursued this thing called exposure robotics. It was one of Nigeria's first, if not Nigeria's first, robotics boot camps. It was for targeted high school students, and it was free for the attendees. We were sponsored by Shell and Interswitch. I think First Bank at some point. We did that for 3 years. So did that with my MIT colleagues, founded it, ran it, graduated, I think, over 120 students overall. And all of these students now, some of them are well-known, but they've all, like, their lives are more or less transformed. They learned how to build and program robots. So, you know, they all kind of understood software after the 3 month experience that they had during the summers. And then when I graduated from MIT and moved back in 2015, I wanted to scale up that concept. I wanted to build a school that would allow students to focus on some of the things that the students who attended my summer camps would focus on. So it was called Makers Academy. That was the name, and it was the concept. It was supposed to be an elite school for kids who were intellectually gifted, and the school would give them the opportunity to get their hands dirty, you know, whether it's making things, that could be carpentry, it could be metallurgy, it could be electronics, it could be software, it could be music, it could be art, just doing things, right? Like exercising that part of your brain that creates, right? The idea was that, you know, I think education generally trains people specifically to work for companies in certain roles. But the people who create these companies, I think that many of them are kind of makers at heart. And at a time, I was using the likes of Zuckerberg, Gates, Musk as examples of, you know, yeah, they went to school, some of them dropped out, but I think what most defines them is that they make things. And I wanted to see if we could create a generation of Africans that just make things, that their nature is to make. Their nature isn't to find rent-seeking opportunities or collect qualifications from every school in the world or, you know, pursue a typical career, but people who create things that didn't exist before. So that was the idea. That's what took me to Nigeria. So I ended up doing that, and I focused on that for 2 years, raised some money from investors. Wanted to build a school in Enugu. Spent a lot of time in conversation with the government then. This was 2016. It was given an opportunity to do it in Ife as well, in Abuja. But, you know, it was a massive project, massive undertaking. We did end up hiring some, like, truly world-class architects and designing, like, a master plan, an amazing master plan that I still have. But it was taking a long time, and I thought to myself, I could potentially exhaust my youth, you know, spinning my tires and trying to get this thing off the ground, you know? Or I could maybe find a way to make my own money and then just do this on my own, right? Because, I don't know, I'll always be passionate about education, so I can always return to the same dream decades down the road if I want. So I wanted to switch to something that was more industrial. So I built a factory and raised more money, built a palm oil factory in Enugu. Ended up joining Paystack, the fintech. Was there for almost 9 months and left just a few months before they sold. And then left from there to Rwanda, where I was appointed chief digital officer of Bank of Kigali, their largest commercial bank. So, it's been an interesting path.
Well, I think before the Bank of Kigali, though, you had also been involved with the Makers Robotics Academy, right? Could you talk to us about what that process was like and the impact they had on the local community?
Yeah, so similar to what I did in Nigeria between the years of 2012 and 2014, 3 summers, I started Rwanda's first robotics bootcamp as well. It's called Makers Robotics Academy. It was another 2-month program where, you know, kids came in and had the opportunity to build. I think, you know, I mentioned it was the first of its kind. That's when I had the opportunity to work with Bank of Kigali, who was the main sponsor and the first CDO of the bank. My predecessor, I worked close with him to get it done. We ended the 2-week or 2-month experience for the students with a huge, like, exhibition where it was in an arena, and folks from everywhere came to, like, see the students and see what they built, and then, you know, watch the robots do what they were designed to do. The students had projects along various themes, like infrastructure and agriculture. You know, some people built robots that were able to detect blocks of a certain color and sort them and move them to a certain part of the board. Others, robots that were able to stack other things, you know, kind of simulating automated construction. It was just an opportunity for these students to get, to exercise a part of their brain that they normally don't exercise, you know, as they go through their traditional curricula. You know, so it was a big success. And, you know, one of those graduates actually ended up at MIT studying engineering. One of the few handful of Rwandans that have gone to this school. Huge success.
No, honestly, Obi, I think I want to ask you a question, right? Everyone gets to deal with failure at some point. What would you say was your first significant encounter with failure? What lessons did you learn from it?
I think, the Makers Academy that I wanted to do 2015, 2016, I think that was probably my first, you know, because I thought I wasn't dumb enough to think that it was a guarantee that it would happen. But I was confident enough to pursue it in the first place, you know? And sometimes I think when you're that confident, failure may be the only way for you to learn. You know, I can't imagine who and or what I'd be today if I somehow just, like, went from success to success and never experienced any failure, you know? because you would never know all the things that can go wrong. And you just don't appreciate, you might not even appreciate the success. I learned lessons about raising money, you know, what investors are truly interested in, depending on what you're asking them to invest in. Is it a commercial venture? Is it philanthropy? Yeah. I learned about sizing, you know, like ambition is amazing, but you know, big things tend to start small many times. So maybe start small. I learned about the value of money. Yeah. Learned a bit about government as well, you know, dealing with governors and HNIs trying to get land or support or CFOs or, you know, things like that. It exposed me to that, bringing in stakeholders to meet officials and all of that stuff. So it was, you know, a lot of experiences, even, you know, down to like negotiating with chiefs and villages, you know, bringing them together, calling village meetings and selling them on this vision. Like, hey guys, like I want to put a school, and they're saying, okay, well, we can give you 40 hectares, but we need jobs. And like, okay, so maybe you can do X, Y, Z on campus, and we'll like create X number of scholarship slots for students from your area. And this was like in Enugu, I think in an area called Ogwafiawa, yeah. You know? So, yeah. You know, I was there in the bushes, in the villages, you know, pouring libation and, you know, shaking hands with the chiefs and doing all that stuff, like, you know, bringing beer and cases of wine and all that stuff, trying to appease the local leaders. It was an amazing experience for me, you know. I got to travel a lot too. I was moving quite frequently between Enugu and Lagos and Abuja. You know, again, meeting with all sorts of people, private sector, government, etc., local leaders. So it was an amazing experience, you know. So despite the failure, I think I gained so much personally, you know. Yeah, there are definitely more failures, even with the factory, which is still there, but, you know, dormant, you know, first because I left the country, but also while we were operating full time, just kind of firsthand experience with the dearth of all things that support productivity in Nigeria, you know, just electricity absent. And the electricity is absent, but also the electricity infrastructure absent. So we had to build something like 2 kilometers of power lines, like elevated power lines. Like I literally had to invest money in putting up poles and stringing, you know, high capacity electric cables from the main road all the way to the factory, which was a bit inside, you know, and then that was done, you know, all the money that was spent. And we had connected to a trunk, I think it was called Trunk 30. It was one of the main lines in Nigeria that was more or less reserved for an industry. So the capacity was higher and the reliability was supposed to be more, right? So we would have power when the surrounding residential areas didn't. It didn't help, you know, because in the business we were doing, which was palm kernel oil production, if you lose power for even 10 seconds, the material gets stuck in these machines, which are the size of vehicles, right? And they have so many moving pieces. It's like they weigh tons, you know, and the stuff, it'll cool down, congeal. And then if you were to try to restart it after all of that, you probably would explode because of all the pressure. Wow. So you'd have to dismantle the machine, clean it, and then reassemble it. So this would sap hours from you on a daily basis, and you would just never meet your production quota. You know, we were always like 20-25% efficient, right? It was like we just never got to where we needed to be because of the power situation. Like you couldn't predict when it would leave, when it would come back, whether it would be stable, you know, down to the roads. I mean, we would take delivery of several tons, say like 30 tons of kernel on a daily basis every other day. And these are on massive trucks, really long trucks, like 20, 25, 30 foot long trucks. And the roads that they were passing on were dirt roads. And when it rains, it turns to mud and the roads aren't level. Sometimes you have gullies as deep as like 2 feet, 3 feet. And these trucks still need to like reach the factory. And they would sometimes get stuck. They would sometimes almost tip over. I mean, so seeing all these things firsthand and seeing how difficult it was to just make it happen, you know? So, you know, kind of being intimately familiar with the challenges of doing any sort of real sector business in Nigeria, you know, and also dealing with to some extent, you know, government making up random tariffs. You know, you end up with a sticker or paint on your gate. Someone is saying that you have to pay for trash collection. Meanwhile, you don't generate trash and no one collects trash in that area. But if you don't do it, they kind of beat up your security guard or your staff and take them to prison. And then not only do you have to pay the fines and the fees, you have to bail your folks out from prison. Just all sorts of insane things or theft of valuable pieces of equipment and dealing with the police, trying to file reports in the police station and dealing with that whole thing. Like just kind of experiencing Nigeria firsthand, you know?
Yeah.
Very, very valuable insight, you know, for someone who wants to be involved in Nigeria. So, yeah, a failure, but lots of lessons learned.
It's interesting because you really had to get your hands dirty and go into the real, I would say, hardware sector in Nigeria. So when you then transition to like a pay stack or even into digital banking with Bank of Kigali, what would you say are some of the insights you've learned as to what technology can unlock for Africans on the continent?
So what type of technology? Is this software or
Software, basically.
Energy?
Software.
Yeah. Software stands to offer a lot in the way of efficiency, you know, and organization. I think that's kind of where software thrives. I think there's still so much that's disorganized. If you look at agriculture alone, I mean, the markets are disorganized. Knowing who's producing what, how much, where it needs to go. Medicine, not just in Nigeria, but across Africa, knowing what pharmacies have what drugs or what medical equipment, so you don't have to travel up and down the whole town to see if you can possibly find that one thing that you need, having inventory management systems, or for government, making administration more efficient. One great example is property rights and management. You know, who's been issued what plot of land, you know, generating CFOs and all of that. You know, in Nigeria, in many places, this is still a bafflingly manual process. I remember trying to get the CFO for the land that our factory sits on. Till today, we don't have it. Not for lack of trying. I remember going to the building for the Ministry of Lands, and it looked like after the war in 66,
Jesus,
like nothing had happened. Like I swear there were bullet holes in that building, you know, the cement walls were deteriorated and there was no power. There was dust everywhere. Like it didn't look like anyone could possibly be in that. It looked like a shell, but lo and behold,
or any records really.
That's right. You know, but you had a whole phalanx of staff in there and, you know, you end up with, so the records were there, but they were written in notebooks. I still have photos of this. These are like the typical notebooks that you find in Nigeria that kids buy when they go to local secondary schools. And then, you know, the person who's been assigned to ex CFO, it's literally written in ink in a notebook that's on the floor, stacked underneath maybe 1,000 other notebooks on the floor, right? Collecting dust, being eaten by all manner of, you know, creatures, rats, insects. Just rotting away. And I was like, holy crap. So if they issued my CFO, if I had registered for it 5 years ago, how would they even begin to find that record? So, obviously that is a special problem. Because I'm sure there's technology out there that could have helped them improve whatever they thought they were doing over there. But I think political will was just lacking the awareness. Technology stands to help us improve a whole raft of things. You know, I think fintech is one thing. I think there are a lot of people in that business because there's so much money there. But you're still able to send money, receive money, collect payments as a merchant, do some basic accounting. Look, software, we stand to gain so much from software in Africa.
What would you say was your experience raising funds for some of the startups you launched? And what advice would you have for like first-time founders in navigating the fundraising, especially the current fundraising environment as well?
I mean, so many lessons. I think, first of all, if a person is young, I just don't know how you can force a person to be humble. Like, humility is so important. And that can mean a lot of different things, you know. Like, you can't assume their idea is so amazing that people just owe you money, you know. It's never like that. You know, one important lesson I think for me is, you know, that this paradox of, like, when you really need the money, sometimes it doesn't come, but when you don't need the money, you tend to, you know, have access to so much of it. You know, it's one of these, like, you know, semi-fundamental rules of life, you know. Try to stand on good footing, right? Whether that means having amazing grades and getting an amazing job and really not having to do this entrepreneurship thing, not approaching it from a position of desperation, right? Just, you know, being a strong person who might not even need this. I think that's how you become the most attractive to people who have the money, right? Because you've already proven to be a productive human being. I think that's one important lesson. I think that relates to business. If you have a startup, I mean, as much as possible, try to have traction before you start looking for money, right? It doesn't have to be a lot of money. Just prove that people want this thing that you're selling, right? Sell it 10 times, 20 times, 100 times, right? Just to show that, people are buying this. You know, just help us make more so we can sell more, right? As opposed to saying, hey, I have this idea. Hey, please give me some money. Otherwise, I'll be homeless. That never works, right? Obviously, there are people who are able to raise money with just an idea, maybe just a pitch deck or without, but these are relationships. These are pedigrees. The quality of the idea, the technical prowess of the founders, right? If you're like an artificial intelligence prodigy, right? People are going to throw money at you. Just whenever you figure out what you want to do, just here's some money, right? But you really have to be bringing something to the table. You need leverage, you know? Yeah. And of course, relationships are super important. I think people trust is a huge factor in this equation. People feel that they've known you for a while. They feel like they understand what makes you tick. I think they'd be more likely, or they'd be able to assess, like, whether they should give you money, how much money, under what terms. And I think lately, the topic of valuation, I think, is something that entrepreneurs need to think about. You know, we've exited a historic bull market where just about everything was inflated, including startup valuations, and people were able to ask for enormous sums of money at a pre-seed stage, idea stage, for crazy valuations. Give me $1 million at a 10 mil valuation. Some people can still manage to do this, but again, it comes down to, you know, factors, the idea, the founder, the relationships, etc., etc. But I think founders should be a little humble about the valuation in this day and age. You know, there's less money slushing around, I think, and the money is much smarter, much more cautious. So know what you want to use it for, so that when you get it, you put it to work, so you don't have to go back for more too soon without adequate additional leverage, right? And, you know, while you need to be careful about how you negotiate your valuation, it's not everything, right? Famous thing, it's better to own a small percentage of a massive thing than own the whole of something that's never going to be worth anything, right? So many lessons that I learned. Yeah, and I think for me, the biggest lesson of all is the one on leverage, just making sure that you're set personally. You have leverage personally. You are productive and respected personally before you try to go out. You know, never approach entrepreneurship from a position of desperation. That's probably the biggest lesson that I learned.
Yeah. It's so funny because there's a lot of nuance involved in that too. But then even if we're to peel a lot of what you just said back, because I totally believe in what you just said, but I've also seen a situation where founders have that desperation because obviously they're also coming from an environment of, I know Nigerians, we use the word sapa, right? And I think for people like maybe me and you, who might not necessarily have grown up, it's not to say that we didn't grow up with any struggle, but there's a different psychological profile, right? When you're coming into the entrepreneurship as, this is actually my way out of poverty as well. Like, if I feel like if I solve this, I solve this pain point, not just for other people, but also for myself. I think managing that, that psyche throughout that process is very important, because I do believe, like, even investors can sense that desperation if it's not managed carefully.
Yeah, no, I mean, as an investor, right, you would be wise to develop an ability to sniff that out, right? I mean, because you know, you're thinking, okay, I give this guy $1 million. He's desperate. You know, he's not coming from a great place. Is he going to embezzle this 1M and find a way of spending it on himself at every opportunity? Or is he going to use towards the business, right? Like, it's a very serious thing, you know? And I don't know, I don't have the data on how this impacts success, but I would just imagine anecdotally that, you know, a person that's approaching something from a position of, hey, this is a problem, and I have this great idea to solve it. It's about the problem. And it's about the solution. It's not about, ah, I'm so broke. I'm so this, I'm so that, right? Because there are other ways to make money apart from raising money for some random idea and then paying yourself a salary, you know? I'm very much against raising money out of desperation. It's not good for the founder. It's not good for the investor. And if, you know, for the people that did grow up and their experience can be described as sata, I think they should, you know, maybe get some education in something and find a job and achieve some level of stability first before they try and go out and do something entrepreneurial, you know? And I also think that when you're not desperate, I think inspiration comes more freely and it's much more genuine inspiration. You know, you have time to reflect on problems. You have time to breathe. But if you're just kind of running from paycheck to paycheck or from meal to meal, just kind of scraping to get by, you're preoccupied with survival, right? And I think inspiration is much less likely to find you. I think inspiration requires a level of calm and meditation, you know, and that's hard to do when you're desperate. So
I know a big part of, you said that education is a big part of even solving some of our challenges, right? I was reading a New Yorker profile on Sam Altman, the founder of OpenAI. Right. And they were talking through his, and this was in 2016 before he had even ChatGPT had come to the surface. Right. And he was talking about his viewpoint of the world and what he believes AI can achieve. And I remember just reflecting, or at least being saddened by the fact that like some of the best minds in the world are pushing the envelope for like what humans are capable of achieving. And sometimes in Africa, it feels like we're still dealing with problems that are like, you know, stuck in another time. And it's like, I'm seeing pitch decks of like, hey, I'm still trying to unlock payments in places like Zambia. I'm still trying to do something that's been solved in another part of the world, like centuries ago. Right. And I keep saying to myself, like, how can we actually compete on a global scale if we don't leapfrog? So I think the question really is more of like, what are your thoughts around that? Cause I'm sure like it's almost like traveling through a portal, right? Like you go through, so another portal, this society is like maybe 40 years into the future. You go back into maybe an African portal and we're still in the past. What are your thoughts on what we need to do to actually leapfrog?
So leapfrogging is an interesting concept, right? Now, no doubt, Africa has leapfrogged. You can argue that Africa needs to leapfrog. I think that is debatable. But I'm convicted that leapfrogging isn't everything, and sometimes it's just not appropriate. Like if you think about, you know, what you can call like the balance sheet of your civilization, right? Like you look at America, they've been building for hundreds of years, right? So there are railways that are still operational that have been there before your grandparents were born, right? They're still moving goods up and down the North America. Ports, roads, Harvard is like 400 years old, right? Like, so at school, they've been doing it for a minute, right? And then knowledge also is an intangible asset, right? But has value. And it's been accumulating over all this time. And I feel like what you're seeing today rests atop all of those assets, atop that balance sheet.
Compounding.
Absolutely. And Africa's balance sheet is just scant, period, right? Now, there are a lot of reasons for this, right? And it's not because we were destined to be behind, right? It's just the pace of our development was a bit different because, I don't know, mangoes literally fell on your head from the tree and the sun was always shining. So why stress yourself, right? But we were moving. We were developing, right? You know, like we didn't have to like concoct creative ways of staying warm and
surviving.
We didn't need this, right? Yeah. So we just, you know, this is one theory of why things developed the way that you did, right? But you ended up with civilizations in the West and to the East that had moved much further ahead than we had in Africa, where they say life began. And then those guys eventually came back to disrupt everything that we were doing and colonize us and enslave us, right? So we just don't have that stock, of investment that's been accumulating for centuries. So I think we need to catch up. We need good governance, people that are going to build great roads, put in place great schools with great models that allow us to keep financing them and can allow us to afford every citizen a basic level of education to be productive, and then the brightest amongst us, offer them the opportunity to pursue higher education and then eventually start innovating, right? Like if you're struggling to find a job that can pay you a decent wage, that you can afford good clothing or nutritious food, right? Or a reliable form of transportation. Like why, like how can you think about artificial intelligence?
It's not
realistic.
Yeah.
Right? You just can't. And I think we have to be smart as Africans or as people that originate from developing areas of the world. We have to be smart, we need to kind of, I'd say, arm ourselves with resources, right? Find a way to trade on what we do have, right? A lot of us have commodities, which I think we've exploited quite poorly. We sell the commodities raw at the least that they're worth, and then we don't invest the proceeds.
No leverage.
And then at the very least, you can take what you've earned from selling these raw commodities and then reinvest properly. But we haven't even done that, right? So we need leaders who will do this, right, and who will reinvest and then allow us to kind of start to climb that ladder of civilization from, just traders and commodity pushers to innovators, Yeah. So it's just, we'll leapfrog in some things. The GSM, the cell phone, this is one area, mobile money. It's not here or there. People like to make a big deal that, they do this in Africa, but what about WeChat? The latest leapfrog is going to be, I think, Starlink. I think that's another one that stands to really shift things. Internet everywhere, which is affordable and super fast. I think we are literally at day zero, with respect to the impact that the satellite internet paradigm is going to have on everything from Africans being able to access knowledge work and earn a lot more than the previous average income for the local average education, to people anywhere being able to access YouTube and MOOCs and all of that stuff. I think that's a really great leapfrog opportunity that we have. But
yeah.
There's no special technology for building roads. It is what it is. You just have to have workers.
It's labor.
Yeah. That's it. You want to build an airport, you're going to need steel and cement and asphalt and all that stuff. You're going to need pilots. So we just have to do the work. And, I have no doubt that once we have achieved a certain level of development and we do have that balance sheet that is moderately wealthy, we will be in the AI races and all of that. It's just going to take time. We got to be patient.
Yeah. But even before AI, what are your thoughts even around Web3 and blockchain? Obviously, there's been a lot of skepticism, especially after like last year's collapse of a bunch of, FTX as one example. But what would you say are some of the guiding principles that you maybe believe in when it comes to maybe blockchain or just Web3 in general?
Yeah, so I think Web3, unfortunately, it's still misunderstood. My stance on it now is I don't make too much noise about it, because anyone that's missing out, it's their fault, right? Like, I think people took this recent crisis as an opportunity to just dump on it. Like, I told you. I will no longer try and convince you. If you want to miss out on this, good for you. Web3 is infrastructure, right? I don't know if it's as significant as the internet. I think that personally, that's been proven to be false, but I think it is significant. It is another infrastructure layer that's going to power a lot of things in the future. I think the ability to transact, what is effectively offline, right? To store your value offline in a secure, way that cannot be compromised. I think that is revolutionary, right? You can have a seed phrase on a piece of paper, and then that's your Bitcoin address, and then that's it. Your money is there on a sheet of paper. I think that's crazy.
Yeah.
So I think it's an infrastructure that will power. Maybe first it'll do cross-border flow of value, the way SWIFT does it. It can be local interbank or inter-custodian value flows. That's the way you have maybe InterSwitch. or NIBS in Nigeria, you know, enabling money to move from one place to the next. I think it has a potential to help with financial inclusion because of the relatively low barrier to entry as far as like having a wallet. There are no special requirements. I still think the UX is very far off. And beyond
very,
that,
very
money, extremely. I mean, it's
in ridiculous, sense,
you know, still. But I think besides like the money use cases, I mean, just ownership of digital things. I mean, from the gaming world, you know, in-game purchases, you know, unique items, even to entertainment, tickets, art. I think the art use case is quite great. Even though I think that the whole NFT paradigm is still early, I think being able to own a one-of-one because Web3 said so is pretty incredible. And there's a lot of potential there to kind of like democratize the world of art and make it more accessible to people who maybe can't go to the auctions in London and sell their stuff. You know, now they can just, because there's talent everywhere. So getting them online and into these Web3 marketplaces, I think, creates a lot of opportunity for them, but also for the world to see more stuff, you know? Yeah, so I think there's so much promise, you know? I just think it's still early. I still need a lot more work.
Yeah.
And I would even argue that we haven't even found the use cases that will really make it ubiquitous, you know? But it's not going away. It's still there. It's just because of the crisis, people think, oh, it's dead now. But no, Bitcoin is, you know, the volume is as big as it ever was, if not bigger, right? Money is still moving. Value is still moving on Web3 rails. People are still using it and they know why, you know? And generally, I mean, to talk about FTX as though it's some sort of unique situation, like, no, I think in this this ongoing macroeconomic crisis, I mean, we saw funny things everywhere. Even BlackRock, they were pausing withdrawals the same way FTX paused withdrawals because there just wasn't enough liquidity, and it makes perfect sense. I mean, interest rates are higher now than they've ever been in such a long time. Like, I mean, you're looking, it's moved from. In my Bank of America account used to offer me 0.25 or 0.35% interest or something on my savings. Like now, Robinhood, of all things, is offering you 4.25% on money that sits in your
account. Yeah, way better.
It's a whole different world right now, you know? And that has changed the nature of how money is moving. So it is not the fault of crypto, right? Of course, FTX could have been better managed, but I think FTX, as many other institutions or organizations have been, it's just a victim of the time. So yeah, Web3 is all right. It continues to be all right.
Obi, are there three books you've read that have had a profound impact on your life?
Yeah, definitely. So one really great book that I read when I was studying economics is Why Nations Fail by Darren Ace Mogul. This covered, I think the thesis of this book was the impact of colonization and the style of colonization on the present day state or said country, right? Yes, exactly. Yeah. So in South America, I mean, it was brutal colonization. And they levied everything from guns to disease to tame the people and enslave them. And the book argues that this is one of the reasons why Latin America has such a violence history and present, right? You have countries that changed presidents every year or every 2 years for 20 years straight because they would just get killed by opponents. And it's just wild when you think about that. Why would you even run for president if you knew that the last 15 presidents died within a year or two in office? So interesting histories, you know. I was in Nairobi just recently, and it was just interesting to experience Nairobi as a country that has a lot of character and seems to have a really rich and old pedigree. Like, you know, there are countries that try really hard when it comes to tourism. Like, Kenya doesn't try as hard as I think it could. It doesn't feel like it needs to, you know? Like, there's literally, it's like an endless pool of things to do, places to go, things to see, things to experience. Yeah. Restaurants that look like they've been there for like 200 years, you know? And then you look at Nigeria, that is very different. And these countries are both colonized, I think, by the British. But when the British came to Nigeria, it's like it's palm oil, crude oil, peanuts, yams, blah, 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 all this stuff. Yeah. Exactly. So they came to Nigeria to exploit. They went to Kenya for the soft life, you know? And you can see the difference in those two countries, you know? It was one of those books that really thought provoking. It also talked about, described it as like the disaggregation of influence and power and responsibility, right? The more you try to centralize these things early on, the harder it's going to be for you to develop, right? If one man owns all the land versus if everybody owns a smaller piece and then you let the invisible hand of the market do its thing. Because agency needs to be distributed, right? Agency is, it's an energy, right? And if you're only working with a few people's agency versus everybody's agency, you're not going to get as far, right? So that's why property rights was such a big innovation, allowing people to own things and trade and buy more things, you know, accumulate and build and whatnot. Yeah, so that book is really good, thought-provoking. Another book that I'm I started reading more recently, I think it's called The Story of Biafra, the Nigerian Civil War. I had grown up hearing stories about Biafra. My dad, he was young at the time, but his older brother, my uncle, was still alive. He was a battalion leader. My godfather was a professor. He was a general at the age of 16. My dad told stories about how he almost died swimming across bodies of water to get food to the front lines. Like, you know, so Biafra, for many Igbos, it's something it's an intimate thing. You know, I had great aunts who were missing limbs or fingers because they, you know, nearly escaped the marketplace bombing. So just knowing these things, knowing why Nigeria is the way that it is, why it's shaped the way that it's shaped, knowing that the election cycles, the nature of our elections with the rigging and the nature of our politics with the corruption and the contracts and all these things, this was the Nigeria that we inherited. This is the way things had always been since colonization. Context. This is the way that the colonizers ran things, you know? So having this context, knowing where you come from, super, super valuable. It can help you feel better about where you are and make you feel a lot more confident about where you might be going. I've read a lot. Many people have. I think I'd say C.S. Lewis, two would be the third. Not sure which book to give this third slot. It's between one of two. It's either, I can't remember the name of this classic. It's been a while. There's one called The Four Loves, which talks about the different types of love. I think Eros, Phileos, don't remember all of them, but there are four categories. And, you know, the romantic love, the love that you have for maybe a sibling or a parent, the love you might have for a pursuit. And I just thought it was a really interesting way. And it really, you know, just kind of not having such a black and white perspective on life and understanding that things are really nuanced, you know, including love, right? Like when you say you love someone or that you're loved, like what does it mean? Because different types of love legitimately, you know? So, I think C.S. Lewis generally as a writer, really thought-provoking. I don't think he considered himself a philosopher, but I think he is, one of the more modern philosophers, and his stuff really gets you to think about life and its nature. So, Darren A's Mogul, Story of Biafra, and C.S. Lewis generally.
Obi, if there was a book about your life, right, what would the title of the book be?
I think one title I'd consider is Enterprising Nomad. I think for some reason, I've just been everywhere, you know, or not everywhere, but I've been, my life has happened in a real way in many more places than a lot of people, you know. Born and raised in DC, boarding school for 2 years in Enugu, in Nsukka and Enugu Township. And then, you know, moving to Boston, spending some time in California, moving back to Nigeria now as a young adult, then moving to Rwanda, you know. I'm still youngish, so who knows where I'll go next. But I think just kind of being nomadic in that sense. Having
Enterprising Nomad.
Yes.
I like that.
Be an enterprising nomad. Yeah.
I like it. Obi, we ask all our guests this one question as we round up the interview. It is, what does being Afropolitan mean to you?
So, Afropolitan, the word sounds like it was derived from the word cosmopolitan. When you think about cosmopolitan, when you say that a city is cosmopolitan, you think of a place that has a lot going for it, that combines so many great things into one. You know, say Nairobi, very cosmopolitan city. You can find every ethnicity, every nationality there. Somalia, Kenya, all the different Kenyan ethnicities, Europeans, Americans, other Africans, Nigerians, etc. You know, and they're all doing so many things. They're qualified people building companies, working on amazing things, super smart, driven individuals. That's cosmopolitan. You know, it's like the best and most diverse that there is to be had. And I think Afropolitan, in the same way, I think, is a collection of the best that Africa has to offer, right? Just all the good things about Africa, the positive notes of our history, the incredible present-day Africans doing amazing things, the unique things that we bring to the table, our music, our food, you know, our climates. Yeah, Afropolitan. All good things, diverse, that there is to be had out of Africa. In one place, Afropolitan.
Obi, honestly, it's been a pleasure having you on the Afropolitan podcast. Thank you for giving us the time. I hope you have a great weekend. Until next time, thank you so much, Obi.
It's my pleasure, Eche. This has been great. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the Afropolitan podcast. We are building the future of a progressive Black community. To join our community, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Afropolitan. Be sure to join our Discord and Clubhouse community by clicking on the link tree on our Instagram page. See you on social.